Welcome to New Realities. This is Alan Steinfeld, and each week on this program, I investigate the evolution of consciousness, how we are emerging as a truly awakened spiritual culture. And my guest tonight is someone I'm very excited about because I think he has a key to the next paradigm, to the evolution of consciousness in a way. His new book is called The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement. It's Dr. Seth Farber I'll be speaking with tonight. Great forward to that book by Kate Millett. Seth, welcome to my program.
Yeah, thank you, Alan.
I love talking to you, and I think you're a really radical, insightful therapist and investigator of knowledge. And in this book, you make a case for, I would not say insanity, but people who are thinking a little different, who immediately the psychiatric movement wants to put on drugs, and you're saying they should be left alone. Is that true? I mean, basically, your argument here?
Well, I don't know if I'd say they should be left alone. You know, the analogy that comes to mind right away is, you know, the shaman who's undergoing his first initiation, the neophyte shaman. They've had no... To send these people to psychiatrists, though, I mean, it's like... I don't like to use words that are used like by fundamentalists, but it really is like sending them to the Antichrist. They have no understanding of spirituality anymore. They've made a religion of materialism, and they're so corrupted by the drug companies, by their enmeshment with the pharmaceutical companies, that the actual worst person that someone who's undergoing what I believe is an initiation.
But let me just ask you about some of the cases in the news. Every week you're reading about someone who comes into a theater or a mosque or a someplace, a shopping mall, and shoots people up. These are real crazy people that, I mean, I would think that we have to do something with these people. What's wrong with those people? I mean, what do you say about those people?
Well, that's a big problem, but it's another. Unfortunately, the public, I think, is so inundated by story. I mean, what kind of culture do we have in America where these kind of things don't happen in Europe? This is an American phenomenon. So it's also not something that's characteristic of those people who get labeled schizophrenic. But of course, in the public mind, the schizophrenic is the wild man or the wild woman, and that was the stereotype that dominated for centuries when they used to shackle people up who were hearing voices or in the 18th and 19th century. They would shackle them up, and now they, of course, now they use drugs to shackle them. But in actual fact, I mean, I've been dealing with so-called schizophrenics and bipolars since 1988, almost exclusively. So I've spoken and been involved with thousands, and not one of them I know is violent. But you know, that's anecdotal. But I mean, if we look at the studies, for example, the McNamara Foundation did 20 years ago a big study with, you know, they compared a couple thousand people who were psychotic and schizophrenic and had been in mental hospitals with the normal, quote-unquote normal populations that had never been locked up in loony bins. And the rate of violence was no greater at all. The only cases in which it was greater was when the people who were labeled schizophrenic were also drug addicts and they were on crack or something like that. But so-called psychotics and schizophrenics are not more violent. So yes, it bears scrutiny. What leads a person like Holmes, of course, to commit that type of crime? But he's not the kind of population that I'm saying are having a spiritual initiation.
Let me just get it straight. You're saying that most people we call schizophrenic or bipolar are really, in a way, going deep into themselves. They're disconnecting from the world, and they're in a process of transformation. And if a psychiatrist comes along and gives someone drugs in that process, they sort of get stuck there. Instead of being
they absolutely do. That's exactly what happens. It's what Artie Lang said in The Politics of Experience. It's a process of death and rebirth, and the rebirth gets aborted by the procedures, and not only the procedures of the psychiatric establishment, but also putting people on so-called antipsychotic drugs. I say so-called because they're not antipsychotic drugs. They're not specifically created to correct any biochemical imbalance. They do not specifically do different things, like an antibiotic has a different effect on someone with strep throat than it would on a normal person. Uh-huh. They're not
targeted. So what do those drugs do? They just numb the sense input? Is that what they do? What do those
drugs do? They really haven't, in terms of their experiential effect, their phenomenological experiential effect on the individual, they do the same thing now as they did when they introduced them. When Heinz Lehmann, who was the one who introduced fluorazine, chlorpromazine is the generic name. I may have mispronounced it, but the public knows it is fluorazine, the first so-called antipsychotic. He said, wow, we finally have a chemical substitute for a lobotomy. Now, he wasn't saying that critically. In those days, that's what they were looking for. They thought the lobotomy was too messy, going in there, but they liked some of the effects of the lobotomy. They wanted to have that zombifying effect without rendering the person completely mentally retarded.
I get that. So these drugs do the same thing in step without the operation. But let's go back to two areas of interest that I'm thinking about is one that when people are labeled schizophrenic or bipolar, that is like a death sentence. That is like a permanent evaluation, at least in this culture or the way I've heard it, that it's like, okay, that's who they are and that's who they'll always be. Like once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. Once a schizophrenic, you're always a schizophrenic. I don't even know what a schizophrenic is. The other thing I would like to talk about is, along those lines, is the limitations of psychology in general. And we'll go on to that later. But let's talk about this labeling of people and the kind of permanent criteria the box we put people in when we label them. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, well, that's a good point. There was, you probably know, there was a whole group of theorists in the 60s and 70s, sociologists called labeling theorists, and they believed that the actual phenomenon was creating by labeling people. But we can see so many examples of that. For example, the placebo effect. Now that's a positive thing, where a person is told that he's going to get better, and he does get better because he has the expectation. People aren't aware that, like the in terms of depression, the placebo effect works 50% of the time. That is, with a sugar pill, someone is given and they'll take it, and he thinks it's a real pill. The depression will abate. It will the sadness. Will be dispelled, and it's just as effective most of the time as the so-called antidepressants. So we have a powerful effect of just the expectations. Same thing happens negatively with a negative placebo effect when they're told you're going to get worse. There's the anecdotal story I remember reading somewhere of someone who was in the hospital, and the doctor came in and said, "You have cancer or some dread disease. You have only three weeks to live," or something. And within a few days, the guy was dead. And
That happens all the time.
And part was a misdiagnosis. I mean, yeah.
Right, that's what Andrew Weil called medical hexing. People fulfill the doctor's visions, and so I think we have to get away from labeling. So what really constitutes a why would someone be called schizophrenic, for instance? Let's go into that. Why would that label be put on? What symptoms would they have to be called a schizophrenic?
Well, the most well-known are, of course, the most common are what the establishment calls auditory hallucinations. I don't want to prejudge it. I mean, right now in Europe, all over Europe, we have something called the Hearing Voices Network. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, I read that in your book, and not only that, because channeling has become such a big phenomena. I'm a very pro for hearing voices movement person, because I think that's access to other realms. Of course,
yeah.
Of course, you read stories like The Son of Sam. He heard voices too that went out and told people him to kill people. So it's like,
yeah.
Which voice do you listen? And of course, we're always hearing voices and truth in our mind. We have to kind of distinguish who we are. I mean, you need a really solid ego base to understand yourself and your actions in the world. So I don't think schizophrenics have that, from what I know, that stability to understand what voice is theirs and what voice may not be.
They're not prepared. People aren't prepared for it in this culture. But so far, the Hearing Voices network has been phenomenally successful. Just getting as successful, I think. I don't know if we've done studies yet, but as successful at least as the 12-step group. Now, I don't agree with the whole 12-step ideology. But what was fascinating and positive about it is instead of going to professionals, they went to their peers, and just by working with their peers and being supported by their peers, they got over their drinking problem.
Do the Hearing Voices movement, I know it's big in England. You interview a psychiatrist who's one of the founders of that. Do they see it as a spiritual process, or do they see it as psychologically based?
Well, the people in the Hearing Voices Network?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, their Those whole people. Philosophy is to be, every person has the right to hear it, see it how they want to define it or interpret as they want to interpret it. But I think that just a majority of people are helped just by interpreting it as they're hearing voices. I mean, I've all the people I met, I never haven't met anyone who wanted to think that they were having a mental. Of course, they're not the people that come to me, but they don't want to think of it as an inexplicable symptom of mental illness. So they go to the hearing voice. They want to interpret it as a voice. And who are we to say that it isn't a voice? I mean, my first so-called schizophrenic client, he was the first one that I had on a one-to-one level was after I graduated and got my PhD. So I was working in a clinic in New Jersey, and now he had a voice that they had this. Everybody said he was a schizophrenic. I tried to quote unquote reframe it just in the manner you said. I had told Jim, I'll call him Jim, that I had just gotten back from California, which was true, and that Jim's voice was saying good things. But the problem with Alan, with Jim, was that he was obsessed with the voice. He would go in his room and just listen to the voice and not listen to anyone else. The voice.
Would the voice say? This is your client. This is your patient who said he would just go. And what would the voice say? What kind of things would it say?
Well, this was like 1989, so I don't, I should have written it down, but they would tell him what to do. Sometimes it was good advice. It usually was good advice. He didn't go into great detail as to what. I mean, a lot of people have voices that are saying nasty things to them, the kind of things that an unsupportive parent would say. But
No, go ahead. Sorry. Go ahead. Say in his case.
Yeah, the thing was, I basically said to him, as you said, I just got back from California, Jim, and there were a lot of people there also hearing voices, except they called it channeling instead of hearing voices, and people would pay money to hear what the voice had to say.
Exactly.
So, the one good thing about that is he stopped thinking of himself as a mentally ill schizophrenic.
Because that's a good point. But, the crazy people I met, and who knows, I'm not really someone to judge, but besides hearing voices, I would say they have a look in their eyes of sort of being lost, of sort of being not present, not just spaced out, but like a crazy look, like a
that's
kind of
drugs.
Unstable look.
That's the psychiatric drugs.
No. You think it's from the drugs?
Well, everyone I've met who's been on the drugs has that kind of glassed out look.
Well, what about the people who are just that? I mean, like the guy who shot those people. What's his name?
Oh, him. Yeah.
Well, Tim, but I'm just talking about other people that I've met who are maybe not violent, but just were a little, I felt, out of balance, and they, I'm not saying everybody, but there have been some people that were,
It's hard to say because they're all on drugs, on the antipsychotic drugs, which I believe suppress. Look, this guy, Jim, was hearing the voice. I cured him in a few weeks just by telling him that there's nothing sick about hearing a voice. And the people all over Europe now, where this movement is spreading, are now, instead of thinking of themselves as victims of a serious mental illness, and, of course, everyone in the Bible, all the shamans, all these people heard voices. So it's only in Western culture that we pathologized the hearing of voices, that we've seen defined it as a symptom of a mental illness.
So right. Actually, I do think, in a sense, if we look at it from a spiritual perspective, that the human vehicle, the brain, the mind, the whatever it is, can pick up other signals of thought and hear things. And I think that's what's lacking, and that's the failure of psychology and psychiatry to include a bigger paradigm about what is beyond psychology. The problem with...
Yeah, I mean, it's really a kind of a philosophical doctrinaire attitude. I mean, there is no metaphysical warrant on their idea that, well, this is not a spirit, blah blah blah. I mean, it's purely a purely dogmatic approach. We have the phenomenon. How we interpret the phenomenon is contested. There are a variety of different interpretations. There's nothing that makes the... I myself have been in states where I was hearing voices.
I'm sure everyone does, but those people with a stable ego can integrate those voices. But others who maybe, have had some kind of abuse or some kind of trauma... maybe can't as well integrate those voices and think that it's...
First of all, there's a kind of there's a certain element of truth in that, but I don't think it's entirely true, because I don't think people have a stable ego or not have a stable. That's become a kind of Freudian... That was a Freudian idea that the people, if they didn't have... a certain type of childhood, certain type of maternal support in the first few years of life, they would grow up with an unstable ego, with ego problems, and that was the cause of these deep schizophrenia. So any time they heard voices, the Freudians would say, well, this is a sign that you have an unstable ego. But in fact, I mean, these are people...
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying any time you hear a voice and don't know how to judge, I mean, the voice can tell you lots of things. I mean, it could be positive, could be negative, but we need to be kind of in a sort of balance to understand, are we going to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, or are we going to, you know, channel the God presence, you know? I mean, there's a whole range level of voices, you know?
Yeah, we're going to jump off the Brooklyn Bridge, or what was the other thing you said?
Or channel the divine presence. I'm just looking
Most
two extremes.
Most people who have these start hearing the voices are in their early 20s, so they're not in a stage of great maturity, because people generally are not at that stage. And we're in a culture in which only now, in the last 30 years, has hearing voices become something that's accepted in the counterculture, and therefore it's seeping into the culture at large.
Right.
But that was unheard of in the 1940s. Nobody, you wouldn't find a therapist who would say it was anything but schizophrenia back then.
Right, and I think it's great because I've some of the best teachers I've had have been people channeling voices, and I think they have been the most profound truths I've ever heard, because in a way we have to change our whole psychological paradigm, and I think that's what's so important about your work, is that when there was showing that psychology has now reached its limit. I think it was a very positive evolutionary stepping stone, but like all stepping stones, you want to leave it behind. You want to move on. You want to integrate that and realize there's something more. So would you agree that psychology formed an important basis for us to evolve to the next level beyond psychology?
No, but I like the idea that it's the end of psychology, though. I don't entirely disagree, but as a former Freudian, I think the whole Freudian, which was the dominant paradigm until it was taken over by the pharmaceutical companies, and then it became the biological paradigm. I think Freudianism did far more harm than good.
But if you look at the psychology of I think William James and Carl Jung William James especially here understood the stream of consciousness and coined the term stream of consciousness. And and Jung was understanding of the bigger picture of our collective consciousness.
I agree with you entirely there. But they were, first of all, William James was not a practicing therapist, and Jung was an entirely new and rich way of looking at the world. But they were on the fringes too. You didn't go into a clinic for help and get a Jungian. And the Jungians became corrupted by the whole Freudian idea. But by the way, what I said to the guy Jim who was hearing voices, going back to your point, was because it relates to your point about not having, I don't like to say not having a strong ego, I don't think it requires a strong ego. I think people are in a growing up phase when these things happen to them frequently. So they haven't reached their full maturity, and coming to maturity in this culture, as in any cultures, is a process. It's certainly not something that's spiritual maturity completed by the time one is 13 or 18. People haven't even gone away from home and gone to college in this society, or going to work. So that becomes a big transition, and that's actually when most people have these kind of schizophrenic breakdowns, because as they're called by the establishment. But what I felt I had to do with Jim was to help him become more mature. guess you could say strengthen his ego, but that implies there was something wrong with his ego.
Maybe strengthening the ego is not the right term. I think maybe saying having a sense of yourself, having a sense of your own being and your own essence and what your thoughts are, what your inner voice is, who we call the self, whatever that is, there's a sense of myself.
That's exactly what I said to him. I said to him, the problem, Jim, is not that you're hearing the voice, it's that you're taking orders from the voice.
Right.
You're letting the voice supplant your own decision-making powers.
Right.
The problem is, instead of, why not listen to the voice as a consultant, but don't let the voice, take over your life so there's no you there.
Right. I think that's great advice, and that really helped him. On the other side of this whole spiritual dilemma are these people who are developing a spiritual ego. I met this guy the other day, and he said, call me Sananda. The other person who I was no longer is here. And so there's a real spiritual ego, let's call that, that becomes dominated by these voices, and they totally surrender to it, and then they've sort of identify with it and lose themselves in the voice. I mean, that's the other
side.
What
do they do? They move themselves.
Yeah.
Well, how do they do?
That's the other side of this problem. The other side of this, if you look at it all as a spiritual unfoldment, they get lost. People get lost in that as well, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, I'm not so familiar with that. These are people who were channelers, you're saying?
Well, this one guy said that he heard the voice of Sananda, and Sananda sort of infused himself into him, and now he calls himself Sananda. This other woman calls herself the queen of the universe. I mean,
these are not people who are labeled psychotic, though, right?
Well, this one woman was labeled sort of psychotic. She was put away, but it was also her ego that wanted to make, or whatever you want to call that, sorry to use that word, make her feel special because she was hearing these voices, and I think that's a sense, I call it spiritual ego. I say it's like, just be yourself. Come on. I mean, it's great if you're channeling, but don't say, you're the voice of God, I mean, say you're one of the voices, but people get these sense of their, I guess it's a messiah complex.
This is actually the revolutionary one of my radical ideas. I believe this is a positive thing, and that it's part of, as Paul Levy said when I interviewed him, it's part of the awakening up process, because we're as a culture we're being summoned by the divine to go so much higher and further than we've ever gone before. People who get what I would call a calling often have, as you say, Jung called it ego inflation. I think that's probably the same thing you're saying. But as Paul said, that's part of the whole wakening up process frequently.
Well, it is. The problem is when these people say they are the only ones, it's they are the voice of God. And that's where I think the kind of self-importance becomes, I don't want to use the word psychotic, but a little off balance. When they
say I want to encourage this importance. I want to encourage people who are, my point is that when people say, I have a mission to save the world, I want to say, yes, you do. Yes, you do. And
say they're the only ones? It's just me. Listen to me. Follow me. Would you say that's
a
good
thing? Yeah, but you usually don't get an... Here's a woman that wrote I developed a friendship with this woman who was labeled schizophrenic. Unfortunately, Alan, I wasn't able to convince her to get off the psychiatric drugs or to take an anti-psychiatric viewpoint. But she put this online. Hi, I am a 31-year-old. This was about 7 years ago, six years ago. I'm a 31-year-old single mom, and I have bipolar disorder with psychosis, When I go into mania, I have conversations with God, and he has told me how he plans to bring together the plan for the ages, or how he is going to bring about global awareness. And this is something I have to do. Now, every time... Now, she put this...
I like that. I would say that woman's definitely having a spiritual... I mean, from what you just read, it sounds like a lot of people I talk to all the time.
Yeah, so she goes on. Let's see if you... Now, every time I go into mania, I'm consumed by it. When I come out, I am normal, but still believe it. I mean, what better thing is there to believe than God has chosen you to do an earthly mission for him?
I agree
anyway,
with you there.
So I wrote
totally,
a...
I totally agree.
Well, then we're in agreement. So, yeah, I can tell you, every shrink said to her, you have delusions of grandeur, narcissism, you're compensating for your weak, impoverished ego, blah, blah, blah. So I said to her, you're right. This is, you do have a mission. Mm-hmm. And
I agree with you there. I like your approach. Should we talk to this woman, Diane, and see what she has to say about
her?
Yeah,
okay.
Do you want to give us a little background on who Diane is, and I'll tell the guys at the station to get her online?
Yeah, she was one of the people I interviewed for the book, but several of the people I interviewed I couldn't put in the book because it was too long, so she was someone who was labeled bipolar by the psychiatric establishment and has proven them wrong. She's also had a number of spiritual experiences and supernatural experiences that they were convinced were delusions, and she's been off the drugs for years now, and she's a successful mother and a successful housewife and works and goes to school as well.
Can you just define bipolar and how that's different than schizophrenia, according to, you know, the establishment?
Well, yeah, I mean, basically, they can use it for everything. They got bipolar 1 and bipolar 2, but essentially most people that are labeled bipolar are people, most of them, at least bipolar 1, hear voices or in a so-called manic state where they're excited or they feel they can change the world. This is very common. And by the way, I say you can change the world, as I just said. And if they want to say, well, like for example, this one woman, I don't know what to call her. I will call her Celia. I didn't get her permission. She did say she thought Jesus was going to come to her first. So I didn't say no. Jesus isn't going to come to you first. I tend not to get into an argument, but just try to expand their sense of consciousness. So that's a common way that people get labeled bipolar, because they have this what I call the calling of the prophet, and that emerges in this society as a sense that they themselves were chosen to do a very important mission.
Right, but if they say Jesus comes to you first, doesn't that sound a little off? I mean, you know.
Well, these people, they don't. Mystics are not, are not born into the world. It's a process of growth and maturity. If we had a society that cultured and cultured, that's why I said I wouldn't.
Oh, I see.
I don't see the ideal as doing nothing. I saw the ideal as something like Diabasis, the place where they went, set up by John Weir Perry, who was a Jungian, and he would say to them, they were not forced to take drugs, they would go there and he'd say, what you're having now is a very important experience, just allow it to unfold, and it may be frightening at times, but it will contribute to your overall growth. And,
I see what you mean. So that's a kind of, like this woman, if she thinks Jesus was going to come to her first, it's sort of a developmental of her spiritual awakening is what you're really saying, right?
Yeah, that's a good way to put it then.
Okay, well, let's see if, the guys at the station are going to call this woman Diane.
I have to put it that way.
We'll talk to her for a little while, and then we'll get back. So what you liked about this woman that we'll be talking to is that she went through an episode and came out the other side of it. Is that what you say happened?
Yeah, she didn't believe it. Wasn't cowed by the all the psychiatry that happened to her when she the first happened to her when she was in the army. And yeah, and she's completely off drugs now. That this woman Celia, if we get the chance, I'll quote the other part of what she said. But she had very high vision of Christianity too. These occurred to them spontaneously.
Well, let's talk to Diane because she's online.
Now, involved. Hello, Diane. Well, she'll tell you.
Hi.
Hi. Thanks for being on New Realities. I'm talking
sure.
to Seth, and he was saying you had some kind of, I don't know what to call it, a psychiatric episode, and you kind of went through. Can you tell us what happened to you?
Yeah, sure. I was in the Air Force. It was 1990, and I went about 9 days without sleeping, and was force treated in a military psych ward, and then had like a medical separation and came back to my hometown. And it's been a long time. It's been a long road, but mad pride.
What mad pride? We'll get to mad pride. But so what happened? You weren't sleeping because what was going on for you?
I've always had some issues with insomnia in my life, and I was just turning 21, and they made up a title for me that was called morale monitor. So if anyone couldn't sleep during basic training, they would tell me the reason why. And I was very naive, and I didn't realize that there were a lot of abuse, family abuse situations, and some of these other women who were in my Air Force flight. There were 40 of us in a dorm room. And, yeah, they told me their stories. And after I graduated from basic training and went off to tech school, I was in air traffic controller training, and I started to not be able to sleep from the trauma of these women and their stories.
Wow. But so you
so
just couldn't sleep.
I went about 9 days, yeah.
And then did you have, like, something happen to you where you started to hear things or experience things?
I had a lot of sleepless nights.
Uh-huh.
And I had a lot of like wanting to pull pranks and things like that. I had 2,000 people in PT singing a children's song, High Hopes, around uh-huh. the base, and then I got in trouble for that, and I put my feet up on the captain's desk, and basically was they brought the ambulance. They dragged me down a hallway. They shot me up with drugs for about a month. Mm-hmm. About a month, and then left the Air Force altogether. And then it was a while. It was almost like a decade. I think it might have been maybe 11 or 12 years before I met other people who had the same stories.
What kind of stories that they?
I went to a support group in Northampton, Mass, called the Freedom Center. And I met some people who were also force-treated in psychiatric situations and who did not want to take medication, who did not identify with the labels, who did not, want to go along with the DSM labels and the medication, educating each other about side effects and some of the drawbacks of...
Is unique. They encourage people to get off. They help get off the psychiatric drugs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was great to meet people who had the same viewpoint as I did, because I really felt like I needed those people in my life, and they're still in my life. So
I'm curious, what did it feel like to be on drugs? I mean, you hear about everybody wanting.
At first, it was like I couldn't tell where the floor was, and of course, I had a few, interactions with street drugs as a teenager, experimenting, so I kind of knew what it was like to be in an altered state,
yeah.
But in a negative altered state where that was causing trauma to me was a whole new thing. Some of the drugs they put me on made everything looked black, or I couldn't tell where the floor was, or
wow.
I couldn't speak, or I couldn't, hear things. Or it's very different when you are not choosing it, when it's forced on you, I think.
So how did you get off of those drugs? I mean, how did you stop?
Well, I didn't do it a smart way, I don't think. I think that people now are more educated about tapering down off of any kind of med. The times when I was put on drugs where I had bad side effects, like Risperdal made me lactate.
Risperdal is a so-called antipsychotic.
Okay.
Yeah.
What did you do to get off of it? You just stopped it?
Well, I was sitting at my desk at work, and it made me lactate, so I just never ingested it again.
Uh-huh.
But there was withdrawal from that, and it things looked black to me. You know, I couldn't.
But how did you even get a job? I mean, if you were on these drugs and they were calling you psychotic, you were at work. Mm-hmm. How'd you get a job?
When I came back to my hometown, I live with my parents. I have a supportive family. They helped me do the things that I wanted to do, I have a lot of resources. My husband, my kids, I have a good work history. I have a solid work history with a lot of good references. So that's a plus. I have some certificates and, like, you know, data entry kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. So you got off of it. You just stopped. And did you realize then that, in a way, there really wasn't anything wrong with you? Or did you think there was?
Well, I'm
wrong?
Not saying there's nothing wrong with me.
No,
I think I have an insomniac in my, you know, and I think that I do have some issues. And, like, you know, I don't have a perfect marriage. And I have three teenagers. And I definitely have some issues, but knowing that if I get a good night's sleep, I'm okay, or that just because I'm cranky doesn't mean I'm psychotic, or, you know,
right,
stuff like that. There's a difference in my self-esteem where I'm not, nothing is pathologized in my life. So it's not.
Do you think there was ever anything wrong, or were you just, I mean, like, did you ever think, I mean, do you walk around with the label that you were once psychotic and now you're not? Or do you think it was just kind of like you've been talking about, a kind of a misdiagnosis, a labeling, because they couldn't explain your behavior?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know a lot of people struggle with that because they don't know whether or not to believe in a quote-unquote chemical imbalance or, you know, you hear the different vocabulary. For me, I think if I'm in a stressful situation, I get like a cortisol reaction where I can feel it in my gut. I get nervous or whatever. And that definitely has a physiological response for me.
The average person,
she's in a
situation where she told me, Diane, where she was being told all these horror stories of people when she's a young woman in the army, these horror stories of these backgrounds that they all come from.
Right.
I think in the service, people join for a reason.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To get away, right?
So you were kind of freaked out by all the trauma these other women were talking about, huh?
Yeah. At the time, it wasn't bad. Like, my mind was kind of blown, but then, I don't know, maybe about 5 or 6 weeks later, it started to affect me.
Right.
And it still affects me. And the stories I heard when I was in the psych ward, in the military psych ward, were even worse. I couldn't believe those people's stories.
Like, I mean, do you want to tell us a story that you heard, or you'd rather not?
There were people who joined the service because their father wanted them to take steroids so they could get into a better college, play football, or someone worshiped the devil and they slit their arm from elbow to wrist. Another person was abused by his father, his uncle, his grandfather, you know, like, and these were the stories that you hear in group therapy.
Wow.
In a psych ward, you know.
Wow, so you're feeling pretty, like, normal in that kind of situation.
That's a joke. That's why we go to support groups, to make ourselves feel better about our own lives.
No, but I mean, I think even in those cases where people are severely traumatized, things get acted out or behaviors happen in order to deal with the trauma. And I think, you know, I think everyone comes into the world pretty balanced, and then these things come at us and we do what we can to maintain stability, you know? And if you had...
There's two different ways to recover. You know, there's a harm reduction way, or there's like a biomedical way. And for me, this personal narrative, this idea that you can tell your story and you can process it, and you know, it makes you feel better. And it in a group setting, especially if it's supportive, there's this harm reduction thing happening.
What does that mean, harm reduction? How do you actually define that?
It's
typically doesn't work. People do not recover. They become chronic cases. 80%
or
of
they
the time.
Yeah. Or they become chronic cases.
People become chronic cases when?
Well, it's the psychiatric way. Take your risperidol. By the way, they put them on 5 or 6 or 7 drugs now. It's not like one or two. You take your cocktail of drugs every day, and not only does that physically destroy the body, it disables the brain. Those people, we have many studies now that Robert Whittaker talks about in his book, but they were studies done by psychiatrists, and 80% of those people, 10 years down the line, are not functioning, people who are on the drugs, whereas the so-called schizophrenics who are not on the drugs are functioning.
I mean, I did meet someone who didn't know how to behave in public. I mean, he would touch people and he would be kind of have no boundaries. But then when he was on these sort of antipsychotic or antidepressants or whatever, his behavior was much more refined. Maybe he was being numbed out, but his behavior seemed more socially acceptable, is what I'm saying. I knew that.
But the problem was he didn't learn to control his behavior, because instead they were controlling it through an external agent.
Yeah, I mean, there's two different. It's two different ways of looking at it. Either those are two extremes in my mind. There's either the absolute nothing, no intervention. Where the person is, what'd you say? He was touching people?
Yeah, he didn't know boundaries. He was touching. Yeah. It's just like all over the place. Yeah.
You know, one of the problems.
That's one extreme, and then the other extreme is to be completely doped out and ODing on psych meds. I mean,
well, they go along, because one of the problems with the psychiatric solution is people who do that kind of things are never punished for their behavior. Over and over again, they say, well, you're just mentally ill. And then you see that these people end up pushing women in front of trains. They've gotten away with assaulting people over and over and over again. And that's the way it works.
And who knows what they've been prescribed, and who knows what they've been playing around with. Who knows if they missed their Klonopin dosage for the day, you know? I mean, if you abruptly go off of Prozac, you will hear voices.
But wait, why are people throwing people in front of trains?
I'm saying you look at every one of these cases, the people have a pattern of antisocial behavior for which they are never held responsible by either the psychiatric system or the criminal justice system.
But how would they be held responsible? So let's say they have antisocial behavior. Would say, like, take them to court because they don't know how to behave?
Yeah, they should be. They should be held to the same standards of anyone else, instead of being given the message, you're not capable of doing this. You're not responsible for your actions.
But how would that help if they're not capable and are brought to court?
They are capable.
How would that help them get, you know, better?
They are capable. If you never punish a 3-year-old, you always tell the 3-year-old you're not capable of doing anything. You're going to have a 3-year-old that grows up that doesn't have the boundaries.
I think that's what we're finding out. Yeah, I mean, I think that that's what we're finding out right now, because I think that this generation coming up, honestly, I have three teenagers. They've never heard the word no. They don't know no.
No, I'm talking about the way people are treated in the mental health system.
Right, but what are you saying, Diane? They don't know the word no.
Like,
so what is that? How does that make them act?
What Seth was saying about if a 3-year-old has never heard, doesn't have boundaries, you know, they're never punished. If they're 3, I think that this generation is so much different than our generation, where we we had boundaries, but they were too strict.
Yeah, but I'm not making.
Now we don't. Maybe that's we don't have any.
Story. I'm using that as an analogy for the mental health system that doesn't hold people responsible for their actions because they're by ipso facto mentally ill. You have to. If people hit other people, they have to be punished or taken to court or whatever. It's not. Thomas Sasse has taken this position since he wrote the book, The Myth of Mental Illness.
I know, but I want to also understand what Diane was saying when you say this generation is different in what way.
She's making a comment about different generations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that...
I don't agree with her, but
I wanted to hear what she has to say, Seth.
In my point of view, like, I don't have the kind of depth of the history of the of psychiatry that Seth does, but I feel like we don't really know yet what the repercussions of all these dumping all these psych meds into people's systems is going to be. I think that people are shooting up movie theaters and you know, Columbine, and those kids may have been on 6 or 7 different meds. I don't know.
Well, we do know. We know that those kids were on SSRIs. And that the SSRI, you don't know, but I've been studying this, so I know. And
I know you have,
The SSRIs have a high incidence of suicidal and homicidal thoughts.
But what were you saying about your teenagers, too, Diane?
They're just such a different generation.
How are they
not? They just don't have as much... there is not a lot of punishment in their lives.
And that's a good thing. So they have more freedom, you're saying?
I think they do have more freedom, and they're more individual.
And more stable. Are they more stable because of that? Do you feel more? Well, they're more together?
I feel like we live in the woods of Western Mass. We're not in a city. They don't have violence. They don't have anything like that in their lives. So I don't know how that's going to work out for them. But there's still the abuses that affected me had to do with these quiet little family secrets that were, you know, things that we don't talk about, where people now are talking about it. They're talking about,
so that's you know, calling what's people different out. That's what's different in this generation. If there's abuse or whatever, people are at least out. And so the
it's
trauma
not allowed
doesn't
to manifest
so
the way that it was for generations. It manifested in families.
Right.
You know, it's a dirty little secret. They talk about it now. It's like I feel we're a little closer to the truth.
Diane had some spiritual experiences too, Alan. You might be interested.
Let's talk about. But I just want to say about what Diane just said. As things kind of get more transparent, the trauma doesn't go as deep, and maybe the behavior doesn't become as distorted because it's dealt with or looked at more.
Oh,
immediately.
I agree. Yeah,
that's the plus of the harm reduction model too. When you're talking about understanding what trauma does and how PTSD manifests itself, and I just feel like we're in this position where we're about to get all these people back from Afghanistan. What do we do with those people? We know that whatever trauma they've seen in the military or whatever,
well, they're killing themselves.
It's gonna when they come back, they're 2 weeks away from being homeless. They have no support. They have no resources. And
I mean, the suicide rate among returning soldiers is tremendously high. I mean,
18 a day.
What's that?
18 a day.
18 a day. That shouldn't be. I mean, of course, they should be taken care of by the government that sent them over there.
Yeah.
But anyway,
it's almost like someone has to say trauma causes PTSD. Like some official statement in the world that says this is what happens to people when they get traumatized. They, you know, it can manifest in all these different ways. And if it gets pathologized or whatever, or said that it's a chemical imbalance, then you're not really looking at the fact that that person has been traumatized and holding them in a gentle way, in a harm reduction way.
I like that. So they need to be held in a gentle way and allow somehow the trauma to be looked at and dealt with. I mean, I know it's
at least to tell their story.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Isn't there support groups for returning GI? I mean, that's a whole other show.
I was listening to Democracy Now, and no, many of them, sure, they have some, but they some of them wait months to get any kind of help.
And then some of them are actually put on antipsychotic drugs.
Put them on the drugs, yeah.
But I know, I mean, that's a whole other conversation. It's an important one. But can you talk about some of the spiritual experiences you've had?
Birds,
sure. Well, I'm a Vipassana meditator, so I do, like, at least once a year, I go away for 10 days and sit in a silent retreat.
I did that in Barrie.
Oh, good for you. I've never been to Barrie, but I go to the one in Shelburne, and I've been doing that for about 12 years.
Yeah.
And, you know, I sit. I know meditation is really good for me. It's my thing. Other people do yoga or run or whatever, and meditation's my thing.
Well, isn't meditation like getting back
thing
to this whole main theme? Sort of dropping into yourself so you can really hear your own voice, who you are? Do you feel that?
For me,
Diane,
meditation
tell
is,
me a story about, was it birds falling out or the sky? What was it?
A fish, yeah.
Uh-huh.
What happened?
Yeah, so in about 2001, I was raised Roman Catholic, I became a Baha'i I think it was 2000. It was the first time I went on a meditation retreat. I came back home, and I was really flying. I was just flying. Like, in my meditations, I had seen Buddha and, you know, talked to Jesus and was really feeling amazing. But I was sleeping, too, so that was different for me. And I went up to the Leverett Peace Pagoda, and I was talking to this guy who was, like, working on this temple, building it, and a fish fell out of the sky right between us and flopped on the ground right in between us, and he flung it off into.
How do you explain that?
Well, he like flung it off into the woods, and then I left, and then about 4 years later, my friend, who's a director of a program here in Greenfield, Mass, I called him up. We were talking on the phone. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "I'm writing down a dream," and he described the whole dream. He was in the woods. There were monks around. He found this fish. It was in the woods, and it was my fish. For me, it was real. For him, it was a dream, and I have no idea how to explain any of that.
Well, Charles Sports literature, he talks about those things happening all over the world, strange events like that, fishes falling out of the sky, frogs, and there's been lots of anomalous events. He called them damn facts, that facts that couldn't be explained, but that science ignores. So,
what's his name?
Charles Fort, F-O-R-T.
Oh, yeah, I have a book by him, yeah.
He cataloged all those kind of strange experiences that would be reported in newspapers around the world.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called The Book of the Dam, which he really were the damn facts that science couldn't explain. So,
yeah.
That's a great story. I mean, did that kind of like,
well,
not freak you out, but did that give you a sign of like the
impossible?
Well, for
impossible? Me, that's,
yeah. It's just a symbol of Jesus.
Right. That's what I thought that. And I did put that together at the time because we were going to this born again Christian church and it meant something to me.
Well,
but,
it could
I think
it could have whatever it meant to you could have been what it was. I mean, who's to argue with that? Maybe Jesus did give you a sign that he was there.
Author that I really like is Carolyn Mace, and I don't know if you guys know Carolyn Mace.
I know Carolyn Mace. I've interviewed her. I like her. Yeah,
I've seen her speak a few times. I've read everything she's written. She really resonates with me, and she says, you know, in the presence of a synchronicity, all you have to do is pay attention. So I've just been kind of working with that and trying to just pay attention, you know, no drama, have good boundaries, time management, meditation, you know, just really, you know, lower the drama.
So are you a Christian now, a born again, whatever? Or
she's a Baha'i, she said.
Well, I'm a Baha'i, but
Baha'i.
I just finished this interfaith chaplaincy training at Bay State Medical Center, and that was a, it was like an interface kind of thing. I can see myself as being pretty much either non-denominational or interfaith, you know, one or the other. Well, and my eyes are pretty open to different prophets.
But my philosophy, I mean, it's just for me, is that, you know, all those religions have their place, but it comes back to the spirit that we are. That is non-denominational. It's the pure essence of what the human being is, which is its connection to the infinite, the source of whatever. And that can't really be quantified or put into a box.
Well, it can be put, I mean, we could say, for instance, we've had all these prophets, and Baha'is believe there were 9 major prophets and a bunch of minor ones. And we had all these prophets, Muhammad, Jesus, Buddha, Zoroaster, all these different, you know, prophets. And then now there isn't going to be another prophet. We have to find that within ourselves.
Right. And that's what I think a lot. I think that's what Seth is saying with this whole book that he's talking about, is that the awakening may look like schizophrenia, but it's the awakening of the spiritual part of ourselves. Right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Diane is actually typical of I'd say 90% of the people I meet that are labeled schizophrenic or bipolar. It's more interested in spirituality and in unorthodox forms of spirituality than, you know, 10 people you'd pick up, 100 people you'd pick up off the street.
Exactly. No, I agree. But I think more and more people in general are interested in spirituality. And I think that's the time we're moving into, is the time of spirituality.
Yeah.
And but I think because some people aren't exposed to that, they may think that they are going crazy, and that's why your book is so important.
And it's
psychiatrist, of course.
What did you say, Diane, about
their family has set them out as being the identified patient, and they, you know, you're crazy, you're coming with me. You know, it's happened in my own family.
Right, and then when they're forced on medication, then they get stuck.
Yeah.
Wow.
And nobody doesn't know anybody who's been through it, you know. Everybody's got an uncle, cousin, brother, sister, somebody who's been force-treated in the psychiatric system, and it's just, it's enough already. It's just too much trauma.
Well, would you say there's any need for the psychiatric system? Is there any
I think with a gentler approach, it could be just like a tapering down, just like the individual. You know, it's a macrocosm, and maybe they have to... maybe they have to act out their shadow. I don't know what, you know, why psychiatric system is so powerful. I have no idea how that got to be. But I think it started with the Board of Eugenics and, you know, a history that I'm not really familiar with. You know, I know bits and pieces, but I don't know the gory details of lobotomies and mustard wraps and electroshock and all that stuff. I mean, it's horrific.
It is. Well, I'll talk to Seth about that. Seth, what? Go ahead.
What?
Well, the history of the mental, the psychiatric establishment and the power that they have over people. You know, if you refuse any sort of drug, they could say you're crazy and force you to have it. I mean, that's an awful
thing. Absolutely.
Yeah, of course. That's what they do. I mean, you cannot get go to a psychiatrist anymore and not have drugs forced on you. I mean,
you go along with a psychiatrist, or
you have a whole rap. The family's bought in. If you're a young person, the family's bought in, and you're told that you will be mentally ill, you have a biochemical imbalance. They don't have, as I show in my book, and as Dr. Bragan shows, that there is no biochemical imbalance. And even the psychiatric establishment the APA was forced to admit, well, we don't have any evidence yet that there's a a biochemical imbalance. But so, I wrote this in 87. I wrote the idea of mental illness. This is when I formed the organization.
Oh, do you have to go, Diane? You okay?
No, I'm good.
Okay, go ahead, Seth. Go ahead.
The idea of mental illness is a misleading and degrading metaphor. Psychiatric treatments in mental hospitals are forms of physical and emotional abuse. Psychiatric diagnoses are demeaning labels without any scientific validity. The psychiatric establishment is pushing dangerous drugs, which they euphemistically call medication. Treatments in this century have ranged, and this was the 20th century, from revolving chairs to lobotomies to electrical assaults on the human brain to neurologically damaging drugs. There's been no revolution in the treatment of individuals who are psychiatrically labeled. As an unbroken history of barbaric practices justified by professionals as medical procedures designed to control patients' ostensible mental diseases. But the main change is that it's now being democratized, so that everybody is becoming under the surveillance of psychiatrists now, so that the drug companies can make more and more money. Before 1978, the APA did not accept psychiatric drug company money.
Well, so the way out is what you mentioned before. Have a place where people can go. That's an environment where they can be listened to and held and allowed to work through whatever's disturbing factors are
and
in their
psyche.
And
these places are popping up. They really are. I mean, the Soteria House in the 70s was crushed kind of by the government because people were recovering without meds. But now there are places. There's this Soteria, Alaska.
Soteria. How do you spell Soteria?
S-O-T-E-R-I-A.
Uh-huh. So people
and that was
could
a
go
National
there
Institute of Mental
and allow
Mental
themselves to work through their process.
Well, they have a team of staff that's dedicated to being with them and being
without
present.
Without drugs, without so-called medication.
But Seth, I heard some amazing statistic, like 1/3 of the American population is on antidepressants. Is that true?
I heard 1/5 of the population was on psychiatric drugs. 40 million people are, I believe, are either labeled depressed or have a depressive or some kind of a quote-unquote affective or anxiety disorder. I don't think it's that much that are on SSRIs. But,
right. Maybe I'll just ask the guys at the studio if anyone has any questions from the audience, or they could ask you guys questions, because we'll continue the conversation. But the thing about if someone's depressed, that it's an uncomfortable place, so they immediately take drugs. And and your advice would be what? To just be with the depression and let yourself work through it?
No, I think there's like 5 things that work together for depression, and one is exercise, one's nutrition, one is positive family relationships, one is positive community relationships, and then the other one may or may not be some kind of substance, but just dumping that whole thing on one pill that's dangerous for you, and no, you're not getting educated on the side effects that are possible, and you might be psychotic if you go off it abruptly. Those things are not being told to the patient. The black box warning on Prozac was not put on there. They didn't. The FDA didn't make them put.
They have created an epidemic of bipolars in this country primarily by the use of SSRI, which are the antidepressants like Prozac and Zoloft, by giving them to children. And a large percentage of the children given these drugs, supposedly because they're depressed or they're basically because the teacher doesn't think they're behaving well enough in school, so they put on these drugs, and the drugs cause mania. Robert Whittaker has documented this. Peter Bragan has been saying this for years.
Yeah, but
years.
I also
drugs,
know people
the
who are
SSRIs
not
SSRIs will cause a manic state. So
I
this
know
is
a woman
why
who
you
was,
have such
was
an
not
epidemic of bipolars in this country. You went from 15,000 to 6 million from 1950 to today. From 15,000 to 6 million.
Seth, I know a woman who was not very pleasant. She went on antidepressants, and she's a lot more pleasant to be around. I mean, I don't know what other solution she had, but she chose. I mean, I guess she could have worked with somebody and said, okay, what's really going on, and go into that. But
I don't know if the drug made him more pleasant, because, as I said, if we look at the studies they've done, the randomized controlled experiments, it turns out that they do not do any better for the majority.
Yeah.
If you take it for depressed populations, than a placebo.
Yeah, you got to read Robert Whittaker.
Than a placebo.
Yeah.
So there's something there that may have absolutely nothing to do with the drug, if a placebo can have the same effect.
Well, maybe
placebo,
what did you say, Diane?
Got
to read which book?
What?
Prozac does better than, I mean, the placebo does better than Prozac in clinical trials.
Was there some reference?
You got to read Robert Whittaker. He has the statistics on all that stuff.
What's the name of his book,
Robert
Whittaker?
That's what I'm giving, accounts in Bob's book.
Yeah, it's great.
Well,
if
someone's depressed, then Seth, if they come to you and they're depressed as a psychiatrist or as a, you know, someone who has a PhD, what do you do with them? Because I liked what Diane said, but what do you do as a psychiatrist?
I would go along with what Diane said. I mean, if I was working in a clinic where I had access to the whole family, I would try to do some kind of family intervention if possible.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always possible, because often they're 50 years old and they haven't talked to their family in 20 or 30 years. But if I was able, when I was doing family therapy, to often produce changes by looking at it as a reaction to what was going on in the family. Jay Haley's system was that people start acting strange or crazy when the family is having trouble getting through the next phase of the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I'd have to know the particular. I mean, look, I had one woman who came to me who was depressed. They put her on a black woman. They put her on Prozac. Didn't do any good. They gave her electroshock. It didn't do any good. I had her cured in 2 hours. And this is what happened.
How did you do that?
I asked, what?
How did you cure her in 2 hours?
I'm being somewhat facetious when I use the word cure, but I did.
No, what did you do? What did you do?
I just asked a number of questions. I had her there, the old woman, with her daughter. It turned out the daughter was 40, but she was getting married. She was moving away from New York, 5 hours north or something. And she assumed, the daughter, that the mother would want to stay where she is, because she had some friends there and her apartment was there. But I asked the right questions, and it turned out she didn't want to stay there. She wanted to move with the daughter. Now, the daughter had the resources to move the mother into her own apartment up in Syracuse or wherever it was. The fiance had no objection. And I did a follow-up 6 months, and then a year later, the depression was gone.
Yeah.
And they had given the poor woman electroshock, all kinds of, you know, if you only, your tool is a hammer, you treat everything like a nail.
Like a nail. I love
Plus,
that. Plus,
I mean, they really didn't want to cure the person, because they want to get they want her as a market for the drug industry.
Yeah.
So do you think that's the big epidemic, is that the drug industry is, like, you know, poisoning people or numbing them out just to make money?
Well, I think
money.
It's a combination.
Is doing this, is making people sick just to make money. And I think what Eisenhower said, one of these days is going to be a psychiatrist who has been practicing all his life and he feels guilty about it, and he's going to get up and say before America what Dwight Eisenhower said in 1960 about the military-industrial complex.
Mm-hmm.
At that time, he said, we're creating a military-industrial complex. We need to do this for the security of the country. But this thing may become such a monster. This is what Eisenhower said. It may be get out of control, and it may do more harm than good. And now we see exactly that happening 50 years later, war after war after war, that's causing more terrorism, that's causing killing our soldiers, that our boys are coming home and killing themselves, and who's profiting from it. the military-industrial complex. Who's profiting from these kids who are put on drugs at 2 years old and told they're bipolar? Nobody except the psychiatrists and the psychiatric and the drug companies. And our whole country has become corrupted by the love of money, the worship of money, rather than the worship of God.
Right. That sounds really psychotic themselves. The drug companies are a bit psychotic. I mean, you know.
They're sociopathic.
Sociopathic, exactly. What were you saying, Diane? What did you say?
That's the name of that book, that Your Bipolar Child. Because if they sell the idea that it's genetic, then when the kid is born, if that's the label the parent has, they're going to say, oh, from birth, this kid needs to take Risperdal. So there's an infant, newborn, that they're putting on
the number of kids on antipsychotics, which are the worst drugs in terms of their effects,
so
has gone up 700%.
700%.
Yeah.
So getting back to what your original thesis, and of course you're influenced by Thomas Szasz, do you think really there's no such thing? The myth of mental illness, Thomas Szasz's book, is there really no such thing as mental illness? It's just processes that we have.
Yeah, that was my thesis in my first book. This book, the thing distinctive about it is that I try to take it in the spiritual, more spiritual. But yeah, I totally agree with Tom. I can't tell him about this book. I mean, I say Tom because he wrote the foreword to my first book. We were friendly, but he doesn't believe in madness or spirituality. He's an atheist. But I believe he's completely correct problems in living.
But what did you say, Diane?
You certainly can't point to it on a CAT scan or take a blood test.
Mental illness.
Right. I mean, in my case, I had a family systems coach for 2 years who worked with me to, talk about identified patients and my family of origin and different things, because that's what I was doing in school. And I think Seth hit the nail on the head. If you want to help somebody, talk to them about their family of origin. Talk to them about their role in their family of origin
I didn't realize that that helped
for me. For me, it did. And
studying
Murray Bowen, I mean, he put the whole family on the psych ward. What's cooler than that?
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about then a little bit more of the spiritual angle, because I think there is a spiritual awakening, and you particularly referenced Sri Aurobindo, who was quite a master of evolution, of conscious evolution.
Is this a good point for me to step out here, you guys?
Oh, sure. Well, thank you, Diane.
Okay. All right.
Yeah, thanks very much for
adding your wisdom
and experience.
Yes. Great discussion. Awesome.
Yeah.
More power to you guys.
You can hear this on BBS. We'll continue on BBS Radio Station 2. But
thanks very much. Good night.
Good night.
Seth, we can start to wrap it up, but I'm interested in the whole spiritual dimension, and as you bring Sri Aurobindo into the kind of visionary parts of mental health, really.
Yeah.
Talk about Sri Aurobindo and who he was and what he really represented as the next level of evolution.
Yeah, he's a unique figure in terms of, they're certainly had not been too many theorists, of New Age theorists, and Sri Aurobindo was an Indian philosopher and yogi who started off as, was trained in was educated in England, so he wrote in English, and when he went back to India and when he was 25, he started having all these mystical experiences, but he was very upset that the British were controlling India. He wanted independence for Mother India, and he became involved in the Indian independence movement before Gandhi. And he was a hero to Gandhi. But it was when he was in jail that he had his most profound spiritual experience, where he was in jail waiting trial for sedition, which might have resulted in his execution, but it didn't. But he saw everything as God. I'm trying to see if I have that. passage from when I walked under the branches under the tree in front of my cell, but it was not the tree. I knew it was Sri Krishna, God in manifest form, who I saw standing there and holding over me a shade. Everyone and everything seemed to be a manifestation. Anyway, Aurobindo became the what made him different from most Hindus. He was a philosopher, but he did use a lot of Hindu archetypes and mythology in attempting to explain his vision of the new world. He preached he believed that we were coming to a higher state of society that would be in which we would be we would go to a higher level, completely unlike the state we're at now, where it's governed by intellect or mind, in which humanity would experience the unity with other beings, so that war would be impossible, even death would be impossible. But according to Aurobindo, which made him different, he didn't believe that the goal was to escape from the world, to be liberated from the world, as the Hindus, most Hindus thought that the world is intrinsically suffering. Of course, that's a theory also of a conviction of certainly of Theravada Buddhism, that the world is a prison, and you find it in Plato too. Aurobindo believed right. that the divine plan was for the kingdom of heaven on earth. And
I think that's where we're moving into, at least in the spiritual age. I think it's not a prison, it's a paradise, and we can
right.
make
and,
it paradise.
Right, and the theme of my book is that the people like Diane, and there are many others who are, she's her time is taken up going to school and raising children. But
which
there
sounds
are
very,
that
very
they
balanced.
They can become
the
catalysts of spiritual transformation.
Yeah.
Here, let me read you what this other woman, who I started to read. You said you liked it.
Yeah.
This came to her just like naturally. Said, Jesus is real and heaven is on earth. We just can't see it. We're blind and deaf to it. We are creatures of light, of truth. And this is a woman who was labeled schizophrenic and given electroshock after electroshock precisely because she was saying this. We are creatures of light, of truth, yet live in the darkness of our humanity. Jesus said we are all gods. When the time comes, our eyes and our hearts will be open, and we will see what is love. Our hearts will be filled with fire to light that darkness and the commandments. Love God above all things. How could we not, with a direction relationship with him, and love your nature, your neighbors as yourself? We will have no more wars on earth. I mean, this is similar to what Aurobindo, who believed that even death was death.
This is what everyone I talk to is saying. This is really the basic philosophy of the new age.
Yeah, well, but you're talking to the vanguard of the new age movement, aren't you?
Exactly. She's one
yeah.
of us. So I think, though, more and more that will be accepted and people won't be put away. And I think there's a kind of a snowball effect where it's like, of course, this is exactly what the future is. This is
yeah.
the age of realization. And so I think your book is a beginning of a movement that is doing away with the dogmas of psychiatry and to lock people into these labels instead of allow them the process
yeah.
of unfolding.
This is all coming from below. There are very few, probably no psychiatrists who are aligning themselves with it, except Reagan is against the drugs. And
no psychiatrists are aligning themselves against with what you're saying, get away from the drugs and just let the process.
Yeah, I mean, they're like two or three, blah, blah.
Well, that's because the psychiatry movement is connected to the medical establishment, and there is a movement to go beyond psychiatry and to kind of integrate things like shamanism and channeling, all the things we talked about in the beginning of the program.
Well, David, who has this largest mental patients organization in the country, says that he has 10 million people on his mailing list, and so does the Icarus Project, which is supposedly the more spiritual of the group in terms of encouraging spirituality.
What is the Icarus Project? What is their function?
Well, the Icarus Project was founded in 2000 and 2004 by Sasha Dabral. And this is what they said in their founding statement. I'm a little frustrated with Sasha. I hope he comes back to it, but he's become more conservative since he made this statement. So I don't think he agrees with it now, but he said it then, and there are a lot of people who agree with it. He said, "We are a network of people living with or affected by experience that are often diagnosed and labeled as psychiatric conditions. We believe these experiences are mad gifts needing cultivation and care rather than diseases or disorders. By joining together as individuals and as a community, the intertwined threads of madness, creativity, and collaboration can inspire hope and transformation in an oppressive and damaged world." That's the part I wrote down from.
And that sort of was your inspiration for this idea of mad liberation, huh?
Right, that and Lang, and I try to connect the dots and provide a theoretical foundation, largely derived, I suppose, from Aurobindo. But I also talk about the Great Awakenings in America. Do you know the term Great Awakenings, by the way?
No. What does that mean?
I don't know how common they are. I remember reading about it in school, but I didn't really.
I don't know what it means, actually. Tell me what it means.
Well, I'll take McLaughlin, who was a historian. He claims there were four great awakenings, but the more orthodox will tell you there were two. One before the American Revolution.
What does it mean? What do you mean by great awakening?
Well, they called it that for some reason. There was a spiritual. Considered a religious revival all over the country.
Like sort of the Transcendentalists were one with Emerson and
Thoreau. Yeah, they were a more intellectual part of that movement.
So what were the four awakenings? Tell me. Yes, go. Yeah.
The what? Oh, the four. I studied the second and the fourth. The second was.
What was the first? What was the first awakening?
First awakening was before the American Revolution, and most historians believe it led to the American Revolution.
Was it a spiritual awakening, like in the 1700s?
Of course, it took a Christian form at that time.
Okay.
Everybody was Christians. Nobody heard of Emerson, I guess, had by the time he got to 1830, Emerson was reading the Upanishads, but nobody else had heard of them. But really, you had during the Second Awakening, you had the first Christian pacifist group. The abolitionists were Christians. You had Christian anarchists. You had so it was a.
What year was that? What year was that?
The Second Awakening. You know, historians will quarrel over what it was, but I would say it's between 1810 and to the eve of the Civil War.
Well, it also kind of led to the spiritualist movement, didn't it, with the Fox sisters, and then Theosophy came out of that? Or was that part of the Third Awakening?
I'm not sure. Which sisters? Oh.
Oh, the Fox sisters, when all the seances began, and that
was... I'm not sure of the same one, but a lot of the people who were abolitionists, like, toward the end of their life, they did get interested in spiritualism and things like that.
So what was the Third Awakening?
Well, according to William McLaughlin, the Third Awakening was the social gospel movement. That was mostly a movement from above, though. Awakening was the 1960s, according to him.
Well, there seemed to be an awakening in the 1920s as well. I mean, with some of the occult. Now, maybe it's different. They're talking about more social awakenings, aren't they? Political,
20s,
social awakenings, it sounds like.
He's talking specifically about religious or spiritual awakenings.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like the Blavatsky was one with a Theosophical Foundation, and then, you know, the Arcane, Alice Bailey and Rudolf Steiner, and mm-hmm. then, you know, the 60s. And then in the 80s, I think there was another awakening where what was called the New Age started to really – come into public awareness, and now this is sort of like the continuation or kind of the follow through of what began in the 80s and, you know, the whole 2012 mythos and where we are at now, a kind of spiritual revolution, in a sense.
Yeah, well, now I think we're at a really dangerous point because the people in positions of power are unwilling to change anything, and if we don't stop them, they're going to destroy the planet.
Do you mean like who? Like who you mean, Obama or who?
Well, yeah, Obama has done absolutely. You know, for example, Obama. One of the things he campaign pledges was to stop global warming. He said the oceans would begin to heal when he became president. Well, he turned his back completely. He didn't even go to the Rio conference. He didn't go to the Copenhagen conference. And all this pressure from the third world country, we used to call them the underdeveloped countries, because they are the ones that are going to feel first the effects of global awakening, global warming. That's it. It's either a global awakening or global awakening will save us or global warming will destroy us. But Obama refused to make a commitment to doing any changes until 2020. And people like Bill McKibben are saying that's too late.
Yeah. Well, the whole culture's sort of psychotic, isn't it? I mean, the whole...
Yeah, I mean, in the book I try to distinguish between... I say that the culture's insane, and I distinguish that from mad.
Distinguish a mad from insanity or crazy from insanity?
Well, I had to make up the distinction. I mean, it's not in the book dictionary, but I figure the term mad is a colloquial term. I have never heard a psychiatrist describe a quote unquote schizophrenic as mad. He always says he's psychotic, he's schizophrenic, he's insane. He never uses the term mad, so therefore I tried to appropriate it, and I think that's what Matt Pryde did, appropriated it to use in a positive way, as opposed to insanity, where you're doing things that are clearly against your own self-interest, a state of the utmost spiritual derangement. I mean, imagine that these people are continuing to pour carbons into the atmosphere when all but 3% of the scientists whom are paid off by the oil companies are saying that if you burn this much carbon, it's going to lead to runaway global warming that could wipe out the species. And none of the politicians in Europe, they're doing things to stop that.
Germany, do you think they're not doing anything here because they're so consumed with greed?
Right, because of the politicians are controlled by the oil companies, and also the military industrial complex. Again, it relies to running these big wars and these big machines that they send overseas requires fuel. It requires petroleum. You can't run a jet drone helicopter on solar energy. So you have the military industrial complex and the oil industry pushing to.
Isn't that a form of insanity? The fact that they are in a way digging their own grave.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I do say that the people in power are completely insane.
Well, what's the cure? I mean, you deal with crazy people, insane people.
The people I deal with, I say, are going through spiritual awakening, and they're having almost everyone. I can't think of anyone that I've ever met that's been, but you know, I don't know the people who are criminally insane, all right? But almost everyone I've ever met that's been labeled schizophrenic or bipolar, I believe, is some of them have gotten involved in very self-destructive things, not violent, but self-destructive use of drugs and all. But every one of them that I've met has had spiritual experiences. That's
right.
Not something that you could say of the average person you meet off the street. They have intense spiritual experience of God, of the infinite.
Right. Right, we should wrap up, but is that what you mean by mad gifts? Is that what you mean when you and you talk about
it? Yeah, I mean the two thing by mad gifts is one, the messianic, I don't know what Sasha meant by it. I mean one thing is the messianic phase of their experience, they have a sense that we could live in a world of harmony and peace. They have a vision that John Weir Perry found in Soteria of unity, of harmony, of a world in which human beings are at one not only with other human beings but with the earth and with nature. And that's something that so-called schizophrenics, most of them all have had a bit. That's why this woman I was quoting, she had never read, Christian, right, pagan, Celtic Christianity, and yet what she said sounded like pantheistic Christianity. If she was exposed to Christianity, it wasn't the type that she was
talking
about.
Or maybe she was just espousing universal truths. But, you know, I mean, I think that's the age we're moving into, where people can all access the kind of divine source, or the what do we call the Christ consciousness.
She didn't have anyone to tell her this. When I told her that, I'm a psychologist, and I think that you're right, that you do have a mission. She thought I was crazy. She just thought I was another quote-unquote mental patient who was pretending to be a psychologist.
That's really funny. I mean, it's also sort of ironic that, you know, the pharmaceuticals are treating schizophrenia, but they're those schizophrenics, you know. They're the ones that are sort of out of balance with the planet.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a sociopathic, sensibility.
Right. Maybe when I do an interview with you on television, we can bring on a psychiatrist who actually gives people pharmaceuticals, and we can have a little debate there about that. Okay.
You think there's some that actually want to debate it?
Well, maybe. Yeah, I think that's possible. So I think we should wrap up because we've been going for a while. But tell me, what would you like to leave people with the understanding about, you know, mad pride and your book, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry, The Rise of Mad Pride Movement?
You mean my book?
What kind of words would you like to leave people with, you know, as you kind of say goodbye here?
Okay, well, I guess I'm hoping that the Mad Pride Movement will take seriously its responsibility. I believe that each individual mad person, not everyone, but many of them have had messianic callings, which they are interpreted by the psychiatrists as mental illness, as grandiosity. And as we said, it sometimes does take a form of an egotistical form, but is still a calling to assume a much greater responsibility. I'll end with a quote from Sri Aurobindo, because he prophesies this. He died in 1950 at 78 years old. He said, "The ascent of man into heaven is not the key, but rather his ascent here into the spirit, and the descent also of the spirit into his normal humanity, and the transformation of this earthly nature by the spirit. This, and not some post-mortem salvation, is the new birth for which humanity waits as the crowning moment of its long, obscure, and painful history."
Beautiful. That is great. Yeah, I actually had a great experience at Sri Aurobindo's samadhi. I went into such a deep meditation. In India, at his ashram.
I didn't know you were at his place.
Yeah, in Pondicherry. I was sitting by his little grave site there. A lot of people go. But I went so deep into like a different state of consciousness. It was the deepest I ever went into meditation.
Really?
So he was definitely a master of sorts and still has a presence.
You know, the thing about him, it should be said that more than any other spiritual teacher, he affirmed the feminine. And he said that he couldn't have done what he had done without his spiritual partner.
The mother was a French woman who found her way to his ashram, and she ended up, I think, getting divorced from her husband and just ending up sort of becoming the incarnation, in a sense, of the divine feminine. They had an incredible partnership.
Yeah.
Aurobindo and mother. And her picture's all over the ashram. And I recommend going to his ashram.
When were you there?
I was there in about 10 years ago or something. That was my favorite part of India, was Pondicherry. You know, it used to be French, that part, and it's still quite nice. And the mother herself had a vision to build a community there called Auroville, and she's building this kind of international community, and it was beautiful. That's actually the only place in India I really felt comfortable. But Seth, thank you. Thank you for all your work and, I guess courage to come out and to really denounce psychiatry to the extreme that you have.
Yeah, they don't, try to bump you off like they, like they're trying to do with Julian Assange or something.
Well, they just give you drugs. Maybe they'll give you some drugs.
No, I mean, if I tell the truth about them, I don't have to worry about them coming and trying to assassinate me or put me in jail, at least not yet, anyway.
Well, yeah, but good luck with this book, and I really enjoyed the foreword as well by Kate Millett, who is one of the most well-known feminists of the day.
Yeah, most people don't know that she was in the mental patients liberation movement in the 90s.
Right. And she's quite an amazing, intelligent person, isn't she?
Yeah. And that,
how did you meet her?
Old now. She's close to 80.
Is she? I used to see her in Soho. I think she had some artwork at a gallery in Soho in the 80s.
Yeah. Well, she was sick. She's been sick, so... Wait a minute, I don't want this to go. Is this going on the air?
We're still on the air, so it's okay. But anyway, we got to say goodbye anyway. So okay. All right, Seth. So I've been talking to Seth Barber. What's your website?
But she got off the lithium after 17 years, though, Kate Millett.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, I think, I recommend your book. Even her foreword is really well done. So your book, The Spiritual Gift of Madness, The Failure of Psychiatry and the Rise of the Mad Pride Movement, Seth Farber. What's your website, sethfarber.com?
Sethhfarber.com.
Sethfarber.
Yeah, someone had taken Seth Farber, so I just put in the H for my middle name. Seth
thanks
H.
a lot for all your time here on BBS and New Realities, and we'll do a television show, too, in about a week as well. So
Okay, that would be good. It's too bad Paul can't come down for the TV show.
Paul Levy?
Yeah, did you hear him with me on Coast to Coast by any chance?
Okay, I will listen to that. But I would love to. I will do a whole separate show with Paul Levy for sure.
He has his own book coming out in January on a related, but not on this topic, on a different topic.
No, I think Paul Levy is another key person in this whole idea of going beyond psychiatry. And actually, I want to have a conference in New York where I'll talk about, hallucination versus visionary, because I'm on the board of the Association for Spirituality and Psychotherapy. So I'll let you know about that, and I'll call you in the next couple of days, okay?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks for being a guest. I've been talking to
you. All right. Thanks. But you're going to edit this, right?
No, not really.
Oh, it just goes up because we've been talking more than an hour.
Oh, well, we just had some extra time, so we'll just put it all out this way. So,
okay.
All right.
So I'll just tell me when it's on, I guess. But you said we'll talk on the next
posted. Yeah. Okay. So I've been talking to Seth Farber. This is Alan Steinfeld for New Realities. If you want to reach me, you can always go to my website.
NewRealities.com.
Email me at newrealities@earthlink.net. Thanks for listening.